This is Cheryl McQuaid. I'm with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. Today is Friday, November 4th, 2005. We're in the Labor Relations Conference Room. It's about 10 a.m., and we're preparing to interview Mike Leinhart. First, we're going to go around and introduce everybody else that's in the room.
Doreen Howard.
Marilyn Coulter.
Linda Johnson.
Doug Rademacher.
And Mike Leinhart.
Like you said, my name's Michael Leinhart. That's spelled L-I-E-M-H-A-R-T. And
your address?
My address is 540 Frost Road, Williamston, Michigan.
Mike, when did you hire in to this plant?
I hired into this plant in October 21st in 1985.
And was this plant Fisher Body at that time, or?
I believe it was called BOC at that time.
BOC. And I think you said to me earlier that you worked here when it was Fisher Body.
Yes, I did. I spent, over the 13 years before I came here, about 60% of my time working in GM plants throughout the state as an outside contractor.
And what were some of the things you did? Here at this plant?
At this plant, a lot of times what we did as contractors was naturally the new construction was our work. And other than that, a lot of times it was jobs that they didn't want their people doing, such as climbing, walking the steel, going into tanks, sandblasting, putting in epoxy coatings, also color coding the pipes. And other than that, it was often jobs that were too large for their own maintenance crews to handle.
And then you hired in. What? Why did you hire in?
Well, that's kind of a long story. Back in the 70s, union commercial and industrial work was a much better paying job than in here. They advanced generally at about $1 an hour per year on the contracts for many years. In fact, in the early 70s, when I hired in as an apprentice at 55% of a journeyman's wage, it was higher than what they were paying on the line here. Almost $1 an hour higher. The downside was we didn't have any paid days off. If you didn't work, you didn't eat. We had a pretty good benefit plan, being union, and a pretty good seniority base, but you had to move around a lot too. You had to drive to work a lot of times, and at that time, outside contractors worked for a small local, and the whole state was broken up into little locals, and whenever you drove outside your local limits, you were paid 30 cents an hour to travel past that line, plus by the hour, or they paid your expenses for where you were at, and you got that in addition to your own pay. And they had another clause in there called the highest prevailing wage, which was whichever contract was higher, yours or the local you went to, you got the highest of the two. And they had some pretty neat packages in there, like Saturdays and Sundays in industrial work were double time straight through. Night shift premium was time and a fifth from 6 o'clock until 6 o'clock. You got paid extra for climbing, working up in the steel. You got paid extra for spraying. You paid extra for doing epoxy or sandblasting. By the time you totaled it all up, sometimes as much as a third of your pay would be travel pays, bonus pays, overtime, things of that nature in the GM plants. So it was pretty lucrative when you were working. Very often the jobs we did were when plants were shut down or on the weekends, so a lot of our pay was a lot higher than what you could get anywhere else.
So you went ahead and got hired into Fisher Body. Well, at that time, BOC.
Well, there's a reason I did, too. Back in the early 80s, General Motors made an arrangement with the UAW and AFL-CIO, which I was then, and they came up with an international maintenance agreement, which threw out a lot of those extra pays. And you didn't get any travel pay anymore. And the night shift premiums went away down to, they gave you an extra half hour off or an hour off, depending on what shift you were at, instead of paying you. The overtime went back to time and a half on Saturdays and double time on Sundays. So a lot of those extras were thrown out. And even though in 1985, when I came here, I took a 55-cent an hour pay cut to work here, I made $20,000 more that year because I worked all the overtime here, and I worked 7 days a week.
Doug Rademacher. So. Mike, you said that in the 80s then, skilled trades saw a change in the way they did business on the union side, and so you came to Fisher Body, or to the BOC plant. Has skilled trades taken a change since then?
Tremendously.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we've all gotten older in the plant here, for one thing. A lot of the jobs we do now are not near as large in scope as we did back then. We don't climb in here anymore. Everything is out of a machine. The most climbing you would do would be on a stepladder. We don't even have the equipment to do large jobs like we used to have. We just do the small little odds and ends that would be prohibitively expensive to contract out every little item. A lot of the things we do in here, too, are little jobs like making stencils and putting names on lockers and painting a door sill to keep people from tripping on it and things of that nature. That and a lot of the materials we use now come pre-finished. They're already painted when they get here. They have better coatings available. They don't do the maintenance coatings like they used to. They used to, every 7-8 years, they would go through and paint an entire area white, if for nothing more than to clean it out and give light refraction. But the plants have cleaned up so much in the air, in the dirt, and the crud, and the operations that they do, they just don't need that anymore.
Mike, you saw a change in the amount of trades. They've combined them. Did that impact you?
That affected me in that they were doing away with the painter's trade. There were 12 of us when I hired in. Turned out I was the last one that was ever hired as a painter from the outside in this plant. And they weren't going to hire any more, and they needed from time to time more people. So what they did is they combined us with the carpenters group, made everybody a painter carpenter. That allowed us to cross trade lines and get a little help on the work when you had a larger job.
Doreen Howard.
Now, you said they combined the carpenters and the painters.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to go and get any additional training since you were considered
both? It was available. It was available, but they combined it as an EIT program, an employee in training, mm-hmm. where if you spend 8 years on the job, you can get a UAW journeyman's card. They did, as far as General Motors goes, give me credit for the time that I had in the other trade and gave me an EITS status, which is a seniority status, which shortened that down. As far as GM's concerned, I am a journeyman carpenter. But as far as UAW is concerned, not yet.
Have you ever used any of the skills that you've learned through General Motors outside of the plant?
Not a lot.
Not a lot?
Not a lot. Most of them are pretty specific to the plant. Since I don't work in an industrial job on the outside at all, most of those aren't used. A lot of the little things that we used to do on the outside sometimes come in handy here because we're also the glass lasers, the carpet layers, the furniture movers. You know, there's a dozen little jobs that all fall under one heading that, you know, you could say you're a carpenter, but you may not see a piece of wood for a month.
Michael Fleming.
Mike, you said you took a 53-cent an hour cut when you came here through the AFL and the UAW made a deal. Mm-hmm. And you made more money that year than you would have if you had stayed out of here. Mm-hmm. Did your actual wage, ever catch up to what you lost in the 53 cents?
Oh, that year. The AFL-CIO didn't have the bargaining power that they had back in the 70s anymore, and their work was going way downhill. And the UAW started negotiating higher wages and increases every year, where on the outside they were forced to put a lot of they negotiated a lot differently in that you negotiated for a dollar amount, and then you went back to the union hall and you sat down with the rest of the guys and you figured out where you had to put that money, whether it was into benefits or actually on the check. That part of it had very little to do with your contractor. And, as you know, benefits and expenses started going way up at that time, and a large part of their wage increases that they did get, which were never as large again as they were back in the 70s, were eaten up by benefits.
I'm assuming that you are going to transition into the new Delta plant.
That is unsure at this time.
If in fact you did do that, you were already in EIT for the carpenters group, what is your next EIT assignment if you decided that you were going to take one?
They're negotiating that at this time, but at this time, nothing's offered. We don't have a job. There's about 40 of us in the plant in that situation, the carpenters, the tinners, small tools.
It is my understanding that you have an EIT opportunity, though.
Not as yet.
Not yet.
They're working on it.
Okay, there we go.
They're working on it, but don't know that there's going to be any other opportunities. They're talking also about a central facilities group that will be manned by both local union 602 and 652 jointly. And there may be some opportunities there, but we don't know how many. And that has not been finalized yet either.
Sure.
And all of these things have to go through the international and management, and everybody's got to get their 2 cents worth in before they finalize what they're going to do with this.
Doug Rademacher.
Mike, I'd like to go back and find out a little more about you. Are you married?
Yeah, I am. That was another reason I came here. Is living on the road is not very conducive to raising a family.
I was going to ask you that.
And I started having children in the early 80s. Ended up with three, and ended up being single with three kids. Two were still in diapers when that happened. So they were all very young, and I just couldn't be away from my family for a week at a time without knowing that they were going to be taken care of. And this was, for the first time in a long time, a job where I could stay in one place and have a stable work environment. I was going to be there every day and at the same place. One of the things about working in the outside as a contractor is you never knew from one day to the next where you were going to be. You might be in Grand Rapids one day and Detroit the next. In the middle of the day, you may move from one job to another, and you didn't have a regular schedule, and that's kind of tough for trying to raise kids.
Cheryl McCoy, what shift did you hire in at?
Well, naturally, I was here on days the first day. I remember the lady that brought me through the plant and was going to take me around and show me where everything was. I ended up showing her places that she had never seen. Because I'd spent about 2.5 years in this plant over the course of 13 years, off and on, doing a lot of little oddball jobs in between floors and crawl spaces and things of that nature. And after about 10 minutes, she just gave up. She said, well, drive me around. And so I did.
Do you have, you went into trades as your profession, so what is your education background?
Well,
I
graduated from high school and then worked on my own, starting out as a car wiper in a car wash at 17, and worked my way up to the manager. And he put me on salary, and I was starving to death. Even though I was the manager of the place, and we had about 10 or 12 employees, it just did not pay. And I had an opportunity to get an apprenticeship through Johnson Paint Company here in town, and they were, at that time, the largest commercial industrial paint contractor in this area of the state. They had a lot of contracts around the state, and they needed an apprentice to travel. For my first 2 years, I only got back to Lansing a few weeks, and that was here at this plant. But
we were at education. So
education, along with that apprenticeship, we had to go through a 3-year apprenticeship program, and you had to go to, at that time, LCC was the contractor for our program, which was paid for jointly by AFL CIO money contributed by the hourly workers and the contractors. That was a 3-year program, 4 terms a year, and it had a graduated raise program. Every 6 months you got a raise until you completed it at the end of 3 years. You also had to put in 1,000 hours every 6 months to get that raise. And I graduated from that and actually ended up teaching the class where they used to send their UAW members to down at LCC for a while. That's about it.
Okay.
Other than the education classes that they've given in here, which are pretty much standard.
And Mike, do you have any military background?
No.
I wanted to ask you about, you worked outside, you came in and you said you'd already were familiar with the plant, but could you share your first job? And was it a pleasurable day for you?
It was a terrible week. I set building 15 on fire.
Do tell.
They were in a rush. They had pulled me back from a job at Ann Arbor School of Architecture and Art to the Lansing area because they needed more bodies. They had to get Building 15 painted so that they could start getting the equipment in. And I had parked a large airless compressor with instant dry paint on one of the landings out there to the stairways upstairs where the bathrooms were at. At that time, the bathrooms weren't even in yet. It was just all an open area. And break times were always very tightly regulated. You didn't stop until 10 o'clock, and you sat down for 10 minutes in your designated area, and then you got back up and went at it. So when 10 o'clock rolled around, everybody just dropped whatever they were doing and rushed to get to their break area so they could have a cup of coffee. And one of the guys threw a hot torch across the machine and left it laying there because it wasn't supposed to be there. And the machine went up while we were on break. It was so hot it actually melted the aluminum cooling fins on the airless machine. So it wasn't a real pleasurable experience here. I got shipped out back to Ann Arbor the next day. I understand that there were a lot of guys that were real happy about it because they made a lot of overtime that weekend of repainting all of the smoke damage in the area. So that was my first experience in this plant.
But when was that?
Oh, geez, that would have been in the early 70s, 73 or 4. 72, 74, right around in there.
Oh, so that happened while you were a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hired in, I'm sorry, Cheryl McQuaid, when you hired in 85, was it?
Yes.
What job did they give you at that point?
A maintenance painter. Mostly it was just small jobs, small projects, painting ramps, platforms, the stripes on the floors, occasionally in office. I'd never been real big on glass glazing, and that was something I had learned because somebody was always putting their foot through a window or a door or things here. Even that's changed a lot. There isn't much in the way of glass left around the plant. Back then they were still changing a lot of it over, and a lot of the windows were puttied into place. Those have been replaced by unbreakable fiberglass and things like that where they had a problem, so that's pretty much died away too.
Doreen Howard.
When you first hired in, being that you were a contractor at one point and then hired in here, how did the other painters that were already GM, how did they accept you?
Half the crew was from the same place I was. Back in 84 and 85, they cleaned out half the executive board for our local union. I used to be a trustee there. All of us saw the handwriting on the wall and figured out real fast that the money was going the other way. And with the international agreements, there wasn't a real big incentive to stay out there. So a lot of us put in our applications. And I came in here and I ended up working with a lot of the guys, electricians, plumbers, iron workers, painters, carpenters, that I had worked with on the outside. There was a little bit of resentment from some of the guys that were in here because they had never been through an apprenticeship. Had always figured that if I have enough seniority, I can apply for this job and I can get it because I was a line worker here long enough. That caused a little bit of grief too when you would be doing something that they didn't know how to do, or it was a new way of doing things to them. It was the same way we'd always done things. And they were simple things like when you went in to cover an area up to spray it, they would spend a day or two taping the area off and covering it all up very carefully. And we came in and we were just flabbergasted. And it's like, you don't do that. You walk in, you grab a staple gun out, or a stapler out of some, borrow a stapler from someone's office, you throw a sheet of plastic over it, and you pop a couple staples on it. They were not accustomed to working like that and doing things on a large scale. I guess they had always been given small maintenance jobs to go here and there and do these little items in place. And that was a big adjustment for me to have a dozen little tiny jobs to do, and very often you had to wait until people were out of your way. Another big adjustment was having to work around production workers. It wasn't allowed. You weren't allowed to get in their way in any way, shape, or form. Whereas before, when I had been in the plants as a GM, contractor, everything was cleared out of your way, and it was 100% production. You came in and you got it done in the weekend, and you didn't have a choice about it. It wasn't unusual when you were on the outside to be hooked up to a 55-gallon barrel, and you had one guy running around just changing barrels all day long, where as much as two barrels a day were put on by one man. You had a backup crew to keep things going, but that was not the case when I came in here. It was a little hard to get used to walk around with a little bucket and a little brush sometimes.
Mike Fleming. Mike, can you talk about some of the health and safety precautions that you had to follow within your particular job? Any real serious health or safety violations that have you seen since you've been here that have occurred?
Yeah. Yeah, I can. One in particular that changed the way they do business, I had my lungs burned. They had me working alone because the painter's crew had gotten down so low there were only a couple of us per shift. And I had to go in and spray a bathroom, and somebody had used a different material. I was a contractor who used a different material that reacted with mine and burned the cartridges out of the mask before I could even smell it. And by the time I could, it numbed my nose. I ended up being shipped out in a ambulance, seeing rainbows and laughing and giggling. And it was pretty goofy for a while, but they've changed the way they do things with that, especially with the confined spaces. I know that we had a confined space accident in here that three people were killed in. That one always hit me real hard because I was the guy that put the original coating in that tank. And we had safety rules in place that were put in place by General Motors, even though I was an outside contractor in here, and they were far less stringent than they are now, but they were still in place, and it kind of shocked me to find out that a year or so after we turned the place over to them that they threw the rules out and gave that job to the production supervisors, and they ignored those safety rules and ended up killing some people in there. I've seen that evolve in this plant because I'm also on the ERT team and do the confined space standbys into a pretty safe program where we watch over the guys pretty close as to what safety features are in place.
Could you very briefly describe the area you're talking about? I think I understand what you're speaking of.
That was a paint sludge tank in the bottom of one of the spray booths on the north end of one of the tanks in the paint department. When they originally built those, they had to be sandblasted down to bare metal, and they had a chemical resistant primer coat that went on a half a mil thick, and then it got a epoxy coal tar type epoxy over that. And that was very caustic and very toxic. And we were required by General Motors to meter the tanks for good air. And then when we went in, because we were adding toxic materials to it, we had to wear a chemical cartridge mask underneath an air hood that fed us fresh air to do that tank. And we had to keep tabs on it. What was going on. Unfortunately, once it was all dry and they took it over, and I don't think they realized the toxicity of the materials that they were putting in there, and they put three guys in there to clean it up, they died.
Mike, Marilyn Coulter, you said that you're a part of the ERT. Could you tell us what that is and how long you've been doing it and what you do?
Emergency Response Team is what that is, and originally, it was started pretty much as a fire brigade, where we would answer the any fire calls or emergencies. I was on that since they first started it in this plant, and have been on it with the exception of 1 year when I had some shoulder surgery during the last training class of the year. I wasn't able to go, so I was off of it for 1 year. That's even kind of evolved in the plant, too. Originally, we started out as firemen. We would even train by stacking cars up out in the parking lot over it by the airport. We'd light the fires, and we'd go put the fires out. We'd go into enclosed areas and put out pans ignited with what they call heptane, and we'd work as teams to try to get that out. Back then, we actually had more fires in the plant, more problems with that. We had hydraulic robots. The place was greasy. It was dirty. It wasn't unusual to drive by and see a couple of flames shooting up out by the robots, and you stop by. You put it out with a fire extinguisher and call them and told them you put it out, and they'd come and fill a fire extinguisher. They've gotten a lot better at regulating those kind of things in the plant. It's cleaner. there's some grease and oil left around. If it is, it's cleaned up right away. We don't have the combustion sources anymore. So, and the training that's required to maintain that level as a fireman got to be prohibitive. So General Motors didn't want the liability, so they took away our fire coats and fire boots and fire hats and said we are now incipient stage firemen, which means basically if it's a trash can and you can put it out with a hand fire extinguisher, we're allowed to do that. Other than that, we call the fire department in, and we have since switched over to about 90% of our runs are medical. And we're not doctors, so basically we package and ship. We go get the guy and get him to medical. You know, with everybody being older in the plant too, a lot of the issues are we have people with chest pains or their arm hurts, and we're not doctors, so we don't question it. We just take them to medical and they decide if they're going to be shipped out, which they normally do.
Michael Fleming.
Mike, you talked about one of your worst days in here, and that would have been when you realized that they had the fatality in the paint department. Can you talk about and tell us about what would have been one of the best days that you would have had in this plant, some of the good things that you know would have happened?
Yeah. I got to believe the best day I ever had in this plant was, you know, I was going through a real low time in my life. I was going through a divorce. I had three kids I was trying to take care of, little ones. And I'd been put out of the home that I'd grown up in and had no place to live with three kids. I had my pickup truck and myself and three kids. I had one diaper bag. Some of the other guys found out what's going on. And this is kind of tough. It really was a happy time. They found out about it and asked me to meet them out front. And I didn't have any clothes for my kids. And they had gone out shopping. Purchased 7 boxes of new clothes for my kids and gave them to me. So it kind of chokes me up a little bit, you know.
Oh, it's choking us.
Yeah. Oh, no question.
It does.
But you know, that kind of points to the spirit of Fisher Body, we feel. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but this building has those type of people. Would you agree?
Yeah. Sorry, it was a real tough time in my life. It was just a ecstatic day.
Oh, like, that's okay.
We
totally understand.
You sharing.
Thank you, Sharon.
Mm-hmm. That memorable moment. So, Doug Rademacher, Mike. So, do you consider your coworkers brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
Can you talk about the camaraderie and the fellowship you gain once you were able to stay in one place like Fisher Bio? The Fisher plant, and have you made some close friendships, and has it carried over outside of the plant?
Yeah, I have. Before, I always moved around a lot. In the type of work I was doing, there were only a few hundred of us really around the state that did that regularly. So you always ran into the same guys again. You might not see them again for 5-6 years. You know, you might only see them for a week or a day. Here, it was a real adjustment to come here and see the same faces every day, and you got to know who was doing what was going on in their life. You know, they actually made plans for a weekend to go over to somebody's house for dinner, where that really wasn't possible before I came in. So that was a big change for me to see that.
Mike, you shared that the people that you work with stepped up and recognized the need for you. Was there a time where you were able to reciprocate and see someone else in need that you were able to give back?
Yes, but I'm not going to go there. One of the things that's really neat about this place is, you know, they'll have a board up for somebody that's sick. They don't care if you sign it or not. You can put your money in. It is a belief of mine that, you know, if you give something to somebody and you step up to the bat and take, say, look what I did, you didn't do it for them, you did it for yourself. And they don't make that necessary around here. You can do it for them. You don't have to make a big production about what I did.
Okay.
And that was one of the cool parts about what they did for me is they kept it quiet. Nobody ever told anybody what was going on. That was a big change.
Cheryl McQuaid. Mike, you mentioned that when you would go out on the production floor and paint, that it was hard to work. You were not allowed to be in the way of the production employees.
Oh, not at all.
What kind of relationship did you have with the line workers? Did you have any relationship with them?
Sometimes it was pretty rocky because you had a job to get done. You had to have it done, and they didn't want to smell your paint. They didn't want to see you in the area. They didn't want you in their area. There's a pretty big division there a lot of times between trades and production workers. I don't think it's as strong as it used to be, but I think there used to even be animosity because they would see us all the time sit down, having a cup of coffee while they were working. Well, most of the time we worked graveyard shift. When they went home, that's when we started and everything had to be back in place by the time they were back again. And they would come in the door and they would see us sitting down again. I think that caused a little bit of friction. I don't think they completely understood what the other person's job was and what they had to do while they were gone.
Can you share any funny moments in this plant, like pranks that you've seen played on people or that you've played on people? Yeah.
I think one that sticks out the most is we had this one supervisor, and I won't name him.
Okay.
He used to love to bird dog his people by radio. And the first thing he would always ask is, "Where are you?" Everything he wanted done was always an emergency, whether it was or not, but he always made it that way. He always said, "Well, where are you?" And I remember the answer coming back on the radio. He said, "Well, I'm in the bathroom right now, but it's okay because I'm thinking about you." The radio was, for the first time all night long, the radio went silent for 5 minutes. Nobody was on that radio. You know, everybody was in the background laughing and chuckling because this guy had finally been stung and maybe got a lesson not to be asking where everybody's at all the time.
So, Marilyn Coulter, Mike, you said that when you were in your outside job that you were active in your union there and that you were a trustee. Did you become active or when you came here?
Nope, not at all. A difference in the way they do things. On the outside, hourly construction workers work very closely with their contractors. Most of your contractors and your small contractors actually work hourly at one time out there, which is a big difference here. Usually you end up working for a guy that knows nothing about your job or your history. And out there, you did things for your trade, like the schooling was half paid for by an hourly deduction from your check. You paid for the next guy's training. You constantly adjusted your work to make it faster, more efficient, changed the equipment you used. In here, that was stagnated quite a bit. And I didn't exactly agree with the way management and labor got along. it was always seemed to me to be very adversarial in here. I can remember working for a contractor on the outside. One in particular was a millionaire. If there was a problem out on the job, he came out and he stripped down to his t-shirt right along with the rest of the guys to solve the problem on the job. Here's another funny one. We were working in the plant next door, and we had a 60-foot high bay to paint, and we had to climb up another 20 feet up above the crane to spray, and we walked picks through the steel to spray it. And it was hot. It was 95 degrees outside, so you can imagine what it was inside that building up on that ceiling. The boss didn't want us to come down because he knew if he got us down there, it'd take us forever to get back up there. And we had to get this place done. One of the apprentices had tangled up 6 400-foot sections of 3,000 PSI line into a big ball of spaghetti underneath the crane when it was moving back and forth. And he was there. This is the owner of the company. Like I say, a millionaire. He came out and he's working right along with us to get this big ball of spaghetti high-pressure lines untangled while we were up there working so we didn't have to quit. And one of the guys took a bucket of ice water while he was bent over and had his plumber's butt hanging out. Poured the ice water at him from 40 feet up in the crane. Handed the bucket to me. Just as he turned around to look. Those are some of the differences between the way we did business as an outside contractor and the way we did in here. But those are some of the moments that came about in here.
Doreen Howard.
Has there been changes since you've been here in the way, and you talked about it started out, you felt that it was very adversarial between management and employee. Has that changed over time since the beginning?
I think it has. You don't see the guys being bird-dogged by their supervisor anymore. They're given more responsibility. It's like, hey, look, here's the job. I've had supervisors in recent years where I didn't even have to see them. I went in and pulled the paperwork off his desk and was allowed to combine the work in a fashion that was more efficient. If I had 10 yellow things to paint, for instance, on 10 different work orders, rather than give me a work order for this and a work order for that, I was allowed to go through the stack, pick out all the ones that were alike so that I could combine them together and go do the job more efficiently. I think that a lot of the better supervisors caught on to that within the last few years and have started letting us handle it. That, and coupled with the fact that a lot of our supervisors now have no experience in the trades that they're handling, so they turn us loose and ask us what we want and what we need, and they are more like a facilitator rather than a boss that orders you to do something a specific way.
Since you have spent a lot of time in this facility, both as outside contractor and as a GM employee, and working on painting the building and stuff, what's your reaction to this building being demolished? How do you feel about that?
Well, I agree. It needs to come down. It's very inefficient. So many things in here are a one-off. There's nothing like it around. You can't go out and buy a replacement part for some things just because nobody's used them in 50 years. And every time you go into an area, it's done pretty much on a custom level because it isn't done anymore. You can't buy that particular item anymore. You can't go out and say, I need 50 pieces of glass, and go out and put them in any place you want in the building. You have to go out and measure each and every one. a doorknob, if we have to change a doorknob, each and every one is different than the one before. There's too many things that aren't standard here. It makes it a real maintenance nightmare to try to keep it up. And I can understand their wanting to combine trades and get to a smaller number in a new plant because they just aren't going to need that many people to maintain that building like they would this one.
Doug Rademacher.
Mike, you just shared some things about how we do have done business in this building. Lansing was known, or is known, as the capital of quality. And you just said there's so many variations. And you've seen other facilities. How did Lansing become the capital of quality?
We had a name for it. This building right here was called Fort Lansing. They did things differently in this building than they did most of the other GM plants. Right down to the material handlers in this building. Man, those guys go like hot dogs. You go to other plants and they're real laid back and they sit on a truck and they'll move it in here very carefully and they'll never scratch anything. You go into some of the other plants, there would be one yellow post for a guard post in front of an electrical box and that would be it for the whole building. In here they've got iron and steel everywhere. Because those guys come crashing through there, and they're going to get the job done, and they're going to get it done in a big hurry. It was just a different way of doing business here.
Can you go any further on that? Is there a work ethic here? Is there something different?
I think there was a work ethic here that I didn't see at other plants. I'll give you Lake Orion, for instance. It seemed like the guys there always planned ways to pad their job. Feather bedding, is that a good word?
Yeah.
I think we all know what feather bedding is. And here they were a little more adaptable, and I think they had to be because the building was so mismatched everywhere. Everything was different. You also had a lot of people around here that had been here for a long time. And they would stay in one area for a long time. If you had something that would only break down once a year in that area, well, the only guy that's going to know how to fix that is the guy that's been there for a long time. Everybody else would stand around scratching their head trying to figure out what to do and how to do it. They'd never seen it before. That didn't happen here. Most of the other plants you saw people jacking around, moving around job to job all over it all the time. Not here. You see a guy that all he ever did is maybe run an oven, but he ran an oven for 10 years. That was quite different.
Another thing about Lansing is they say they have a working relationship with the union. Do you see anything? You were a union man all these years. What do you see of the connection between management and union in this facility?
Something I saw that was really unusual here is, and I can go right on down to the grievance level on things, is rarely was a grievance put in on small items. Rather than put in a grievance, the committeeman would go to the supervisor and see if he couldn't work something out that was equitable for both people. And that I found quite surprising. Somebody say, well, yeah, you kind of got screwed over on this deal. Can I pay you a couple of lunches to make up for it? And it never went to the grievance level. It just was taken care of on a lower level that made everybody happy. I give you, for instance, I was going down the escalator. This is one of the escalators that they shut down and replaced eventually out in the shipping area. Leaving work, the thing ate my shoe. I mean, it grabbed that shoe and it sucked it right in. And luckily, I had low shoes on. I was able to pull my foot out and I went to the boss and I said, look, number one, you're going to buy me a new pair of shoes. Number two, you're going to get that thing fixed. Safety department came over and talked to him, and the supervisor actually went in and started arguing, look, we got to shut this thing down. Everybody's going to have to walk until we can get this fixed, and we've got to get it fixed. And a few minutes later, it was shut down and repaired. It's just a different way of, like I say, back to working with management and the hourly people. They took care of that. I had to get a new pair of shoes, but he paid me lunch breaks until he felt that my shoes had been paid for. And it never made it to a paperwork type situation with a grievance. I think you'd have seen it as a grievance at some of the other GM plants I've been in.
Doreen Howard.
Earlier, you said you had some children. Are your children old enough that they may possibly work here?
Yes.
Do you have?
I have three children myself. I also have two stepchildren. Don't see any of them except for one that really wants to be a tradesman or work in the plants. And he's got his eye on the Army first. He just turned 18. My dad retired from General Motors. He was a toolmaker at the main plant. I have one brother that was also a toolmaker there. And another brother that was a forklift driver.
So you have a very long heritage with GM.
Yeah, GM fed me when I was a little guy, too. I was aware of their workings quite well, even back in the early 70s when I did not want to come here, and the issue was pay. Trades paid better even as an apprentice than they did in here back then.
Doreen Howard, you've been here a while, you've been other places. You're not sure if you're going to go to the new Delta plant. The skilled trades people that eventually will be hired into General Motors, what words of wisdom could you offer anyone that would be interested in a skilled trade such as yours?
Mine? It's not going to exist. It's not going to exist. I know I don't want to go back to hanging off buildings with a rope and climbing around in steel anymore. I'm too old for that, like I did on the outside. But I'd be very leery of it because most of the GM trades, and it isn't always that way in every plant, but it's like your electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters. If you were to go to work on the outside, you would be required a certain amount of training, a certain amount of time on the job, and working within GM to accomplish that is not good. You're not recognized anywhere else as a journeyman in that group or in that trade. If you're an electrician here, you could be an electrician for 20 years, but they know on the outside that you may have spent most of that 20 years pounding caps on welding robots, and if they don't want you. So, you know, if you really wanted to be a tradesman within GM or a tradesman, period, I'd recommend you training somewhere else. Because GM only trains specifically for GM jobs.
Cheryl McQuaid, Mike, is there anything you'd like to share with us that we've not asked?
Such as
anything at all that you'd like to be put in the history books.
I guess I'd like to see a lot of the history, of the way this place came to be. A lot of us within this plant don't even realize some of the things that went on in this plant, like labor issues, like the time back in the war when they had an explosion in the plants and we had guys die, and it's never been answered as to why or what happened. Those kind of things. I think those are all history issues that, you know, people would be interested in finding out. There's a lot of things that happened to GM plants that were very different in here that I think people should realize, and that is their labor pool. I think GM led the way for all workers to be put on an equal footing. Because even though I was an outside contractor and I was union, everybody knew if you were the boss's son, you were going to work. And even if you weren't as good. And in here, you learned a different way of doing things. You know, you learned that you had the same rates as the next guy. And I ended up, I think, in my years in the trades on the outside, I only worked with three women the entire time I was out there. And coming in here, that was a real education. It's like, gee, I got to be careful about the jokes that the guys tell, because, you know, we've got other people here and other women and people that would be offended by it. So I think that General Motors has done a lot in workers' rights in the way of establishing rules and ground rules. I think another thing that GM has done is, especially since the 80s, late 70s and early 80s, they've set the pay scale for the area. A lot of guys say, oh, geez, they make all that much money and look what they do, but they don't stop to realize that if we weren't making that much, they wouldn't be making that much.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Mike Fleming. We do set the prevailing wage in whatever area we're in. And there's always someone that has to set that prevailing wage. I think some folk get it and some folk don't.
Yeah, but I think that that's been a big influence. I think it historically needs to be documented, because I don't think people understand how much money is made outside of GM through GM in this town. I know how much money I made. Sorry to say, I bought a brand new Ford in 1979 when I had a good year here. But GM paid for that Ford. You know, I know that the scale would not have been that high for our local union out there had it not been for the fact that we had work here in Lansing in the plants. A lot of the other locals were $3 and $4 an hour lower than the Lansing local for our construction trade, just because they didn't have GM plants here. A lot of those extra pays I talked about earlier, those premium pays, those were put in place because we knew we could get it from GM. You went to other local areas in the state, you didn't get that.
Doug Rademacher. Mike, you keep saying we. Are you speaking of union represented bargain benefits?
Yes.
Because GM wasn't handing things out.
No.
So.
I think that that's where a lot of the holdover from the old-fashioned adversarial relationship came from. I do see that as changing. I see that they realize that, gee, you know, we can't beat them, so we better join them and work together. I'm seeing that. See, when I first got here, I didn't see that, and I wanted no part of any union politics at that time because of that.
Doreen Howard.
You touched base on a Ford that you had purchased earlier on before when you were contract. Once you became a GM employee, did you purchase any of the vehicles that you ever were around that we made here in our facility or any other?
Well, products? 3 days before I came to work here, I purchased a brand new Ford truck. Still had the sticker in the window. That wasn't real well accepted. I remember the orange government paint down the side of it when I went out to get it that week. Somebody in the maintenance department had picked up on that and didn't like it either and had hit it with one of the maintenance vehicles. And they did, GM did pay to put a new door on it and a new mirror. But after that, I did buy GM cars. It was kind of sad to say that when I bought that truck, I had always purchased a full-size truck, six-cylinder. The only option I ever got on my vehicles were an automatic because I drove 30,000, 35,000 miles a year on those vehicles because I had to travel around and I wore them out pretty quick and needed to watch expenses. And even though I knew I was going to work for GM and would be eligible for a discount, Ford beat GM by $1,000 for that same vehicle. So I bought the Ford. Since that time, the money's gone the other way. And I have shopped the Fords a couple of times. So I still buy a six-cylinder full-size truck because I like to have a truck around the house. But they've always been GM since then because they have beaten the price. I'm not that loyal to the company. I do like to buy UAW products. But, you know, price is the biggest factor on that.
Doreen Howard.
I was wondering if there was any other questions that anybody wanted to ask of Mike before we wrap things up.
I'd just like to say it's been a pleasure interviewing you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.